Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome back to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Grace Seegers.
We're so happy to be back with you. Unfortunately, Haley does remain out on maternity leave. I say unfortunately because we always like to have her here in these discussions. But of course, she is a new mom, and we're very happy that she's taking this time to be with her new son and to experience the joys of life. We've got a really great topic this time around, which is one that I've been really hoping that we could get to for a while. It's a big point of contention among Star Wars fans. We're going to be talking about what happened with the Jedi. Where did they go wrong? When was the fix in for the Jedi? Could they have done anything differently? Now, I've got some notes here, Grace. I assume you do too, but I was hoping we could start by talking about one of the reasons why I think things worked out so poorly for them, which is their relationship with the Republic government. I think this is a significant source of the problems for them. I've got a spiel I can go through, but I wondered if you had anything you wanted to say about that relationship and how you see that playing into their ultimate downfall.
Well, it is a toxic relationship, I think, in the wise words of Britney Spears. And I do want to start off by saying I am anti-genocide. You know, as much as the Jedi may have messed up or had a lot of shortcomings or were short-sighted in a lot of ways, I don't think any of that justifies their genocide, essentially.
So you're saying that you opposed Order 66, so you want to be on the record opposing Order 66.
I do. I would like to be on the record of opposing Order 66, a controversial opinion, I know.
It takes all kinds here at the Hot Takes podcast, so appreciate you putting that out there.
You know, it's just sometimes on the internet when you start criticizing something and then someone's like, oh, so you hate that thing and you want them to die. It's like, well, I wouldn't go that far. So I just felt like I needed to really put that out there before I start any of my Jedi criticism. Yes, I would agree that the relationship between the Jedi and the Republic was not great, but I want to hear your spiel, Eric.
All right, so this is my spiel. So I think a big problem for them is the Jedi allowed themselves to get too close to the Republic government. This is an organization that is supposed to be all about communing with the light, understanding what the Force wants them to do, and, you know, It's they faced a difficult set of choices. I mean, you know, the questions that I wrote down in my notes were, should they have been more wandering monks than police wizards, or were their objectives of preserving peace inevitably going to align with and be co-opted by the government's desire for stability and order? And I don't necessarily know that I have the right answer there in terms of what the best path is for them. I do think that even if you're going to accept the premise that they need to work closely with the Republic, you know, that I think they should have pushed for more independence. I think they need to have a greater degree of control over their own affairs and a greater degree of latitude to go where the Force is pushing them. And, you know, I will add a caveat to that in one second. But before I get to the caveat, what I will say is, if you look at the end of the Clone Wars Season 5, if you look at Ahsoka on trial, the non-Jedi trial that they have, the Republic trial, and the Jedi's immediate surrender of her to the Republic, because they have been so pulled into and co-opted by the Republic government, is what alienates her from them. I mean, it is really what pushes Ahsoka away from the Jedi Order. So it's really counterproductive for them to draw themselves too closely to this government, which, as Obi-Wan acknowledges in Episode 2, is full of corruption. And it's not an open it's not a secret. I mean, everybody knows this, but Obi-Wan really talks about how you can't trust politicians. But this is an organization that has allowed itself to glom onto and essentially do the bidding of this political institution. Now, here's my caveat. I think if we were in Star Wars, would want the government to have pretty firm control over what are essentially superpowered people, right? And this gets into the whole Marvel debate about, you know, the Sokovia Accords and, you know, should the superpowered people be able to just do whatever they want because they're stronger than us and we can't possibly understand the problems that they face. But I could understand the Republic saying, listen, you're part of society. We're the legitimate government of society, and you need to do what we tell you to do. If you're signing on to protect the peace, we have the political mandate to protect the peace. So you need to do that within the framework that we set out. And I could certainly understand that. It's a legitimate desire from people in the Star Wars universe. Obviously, we don't have any sort of textual evidence that that's a real strong belief that anybody's actually pushing for, but I think it's reasonable to assume that that's a strong point of view within Star Wars. So that's my spiel.
I think that's a pretty good spiel. As you were talking, I thought of a simile for how I view the Jedi and the Republic and their relationship, and that is that they are like two bananas that are next to each other. And you know when bananas are next to each other, how they get browner faster, and it's like a kind of murder suicide pact.
Okay, I did not know that, but bananas. I definitely did not know that, but that's good to know.
So they're like two bananas in that they are both in their old age getting kind of corrupted and set in their ways, which are not necessarily productive ways for the problems that they are facing at the time, and kind of unwilling to revamp as institutions. And you see that as a problem with both the Jedi Order and the government, the Republic government itself. They both clearly could benefit from some reform. But also, because they're so linked together by a certain point, it kind of, like bananas, they brown faster together. And they kind of feed into each other's corruption and problems. And it's sort of like they're going down together. And it's at a certain point, it's not really... I feel like it's difficult to extricate the Republic from the Jedi, because the Jedi have been the ones who are actually fighting the war that the Republic has been administering from Coruscant. And so at a certain point, I think that they're so intertwined that when you see the fall of the Jedi, you see the fall of the Republic, and vice versa. And I think in part that's because they're both old and corrupt and have problems, and they are having a negative effect on each other.
That's interesting. I would not have described that as being as co-equal of a sort of a parasitism as you did. I mean, I tend to think of it as almost entirely one way, in that being associated with the Republic really corrupts the Jedi, and Palpatine, if he wants to get to the Republic, he has to go through the Jedi, which have been, you know, as an institution, has been weakened by its need to kowtow to the bureaucracy, and obviously, in a very real sense, has been corrupted by taking on this war posture. But you know, you raise a good point about how there's a mutual corruption there. Let's zoom in a little bit on the Clone Wars, which obviously you mentioned. Fighting this war is that this is the thing that really, I think, ends the Jedi Order ideologically. It is the final break between their ideals and the reality. But I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what it does to the individual Jedi to become generals in this war. I mean, you know, not every Jedi has the same relationship with the Force that we imagine, you know, Yoda sitting in his meditation chamber, communing with the Force and interacting with it on this very philosophical level. Not every Jedi is like that. Some of them want to get their hands dirty. Some of them really want to be out there, you know, fighting pirates or whatever. So, you know, this institution that is being brought into the war is full of people with very different thoughts about that kind of activity. I don't know that any of them want to fight a war, but certainly not all of them want to sit around the way that Yoda does. But they all have this commitment to studying the Force and appreciating that it has its own will. And so now they're thrown into this war that forces them to, I mean, they don't really have time to meditate in a very real sense. And that sort of epitomizes the broader problem for them of losing focus, losing touch with the Force. And of course, we see where that leads them once Sidious's plan comes to fruition. How do you see them in the prequel trilogy losing their way as a result of this war?
Right. So I think that the mutual banana browning of the Jedi and the Republic is really accelerated and catalyzed by the war, because it's, well, first of all, it's a very controversial war. It's not clear cut necessarily, although propagandists argue on both sides argue that it is, but it's this sort of difficult conflict that is not easy for either side to prosecute. And the Jedi are thrust into this kind of going from a pseudo police force to actual generals in an actual war. And not only are they generals, but they're overseeing the command of these armies of millions of clones, which also, I think that being a military leader changes a person and the way that they think about the world slash galaxy. And I think that being in command of clones would also bring its own thorny questions and also sort of change a person's perspective on the Force and on war and morality of fighting a war with a population that was essentially bred to die. So I think that the Jedi are really thrown into this conflict that is antithetical to what they are supposed to be about. They're supposed to be more measured and deliberate, and the war is very fast moving. It requires a lot of quick, difficult decisions on a massive scale that otherwise they would not be making. They would not be making decisions necessarily that would infect an entire planetary population, for example. And I think that's a big part of it. And then the second thing I was going to mention was how, because of the war and at the rate of loss of the Jedi, how children essentially are roped into the conflict and become child soldiers, pretty much. I mean, like, yeah, they're Jedi, they're super powered, but, you know, 14-year-old Ahsoka should not be thrown into a conflict. And then when she's 15 or 16, put in command again of these clones and overseeing their death, essentially. It's just extremely messed up on a lot of levels. And I think that the Jedi, which as an order was already sort of failing in a lot of ways, really, I mean, it could only be broken by the war. There was really no other outcome, I think, than for it to totally collapse because of what it meant, you know, physically, the loss of Jedi, and then spiritually, emotionally for the Jedi themselves.
I love your point about how the war is controversial, and I wish we'd seen more of that in Clone Wars, regular people in the Republic expressing doubts about whether the Separatists were everything that the propagandists said they were. I enjoyed the episodes where Ahsoka interacts with Mina and Lux Bonteri, because this is when you really start to see that the Separatist cause, there's a Senate, you know, and they're regular people who have perhaps legitimate grievances with the Republic. I don't want to indulge too much in that because, as we know, the evil people are pulling the strings of all of it. It's not a legitimate movement in the sense that the Senate has no real control. And, there's no analogy there to the way that the Republic Senate it, you know, if Palpatine allowed it, would actually be able to rein in the clone army, or the Jedi for that matter, because that all exists within a nominally democratic system, whereas the Separatists, it's even more of a sham than it is for the Republic. However, there are regular people who are caught up in the conflict on both sides. So to that degree, this kind of dogmatic approach to the war that we really see Anakin take quite a lot. There are a number of circumstances where he brushes off this idea that there's nuance or complexity to the fight. You know, that dogmatic view loses sight of the innocent people, not droids, but people on the Separatist side who may have real frustrations. They just because they're not being served by their Senate or by the Sith Lords that are behind their Senate doesn't mean that they don't deserve to have those grievances addressed. And Ahsoka in those episodes is really confronting something that she hasn't seen because the propagandists have been at work, and she has to grapple with that. And that, I think, presents an example of how the Jedi are being corrupted. You know, to your point, I mean, when you have Jedi leaders who take the view that Anakin takes about the people on the other side, that's just fundamentally antithetical to the ideals of the Jedi, to the ideals of trying to avoid bloodshed at all costs, trying to do the best thing for the light side, for the living force. You know, fighting a war doesn't allow you to take that approach to interacting with people you disagree with. And that's supposed to be a hallmark of, you know, Jedi mediation. And you see Ahsoka start to realize that, you know, maybe there are some people on the other side who are not just mindless droids who deserve to be cut down. And she and Anakin, I think, represent two different ways that Jedi are interacting with this conundrum in the war. And ultimately, you know, for the people in charge, you know, they seem to be leaning a little bit more towards Anakin's perspective.
Right. And I think Anakin, in general, is a very interesting character because he sees things in very rigid black and white terms. But also, I mean, I can understand where he would get his perspective of, and how Jedi who align more with that perspective would come to the conclusions that, you know, the Separatists are, the ones in charge are evil manipulators who are, you know, committing war crimes for no real reason, ostensibly, and that mowing down the droids is a reasonable and, in fact, maybe the correct thing to do. I think the problem that Anakin faces is that he just sees it as a war, which is, that's kind of a dumb thing to say, but he only sees the battle aspects of it. He doesn't see the socio-political implications. He only sees, well, there's a fight and it needs to be won, and not necessarily looking at the complexities behind the war movement. And I think that overall, that does become a problem for the Jedi, where they just see the war as a fight to be won. And, you know, you see Yoda and Mace Windu having and wrestling with the moral implications, but also just feeling as if once this war is over, then things can go back to normal, or we can make things better, instead of realizing that there is not going to be an end to the war in the way that they think there is going to be.
Yeah, I think your point about Anakin is great, because, you know, and this is, you know, why Sidious is so brilliant, but, you know, on the Separatist side, I mean, they freely work with, you know, slavers and other people who just have no respect for basic, you know, the dignity of sentient beings. And there's no analog to that on the Republic side. And so for Anakin, this is a very clear-cut moral situation. And, you know, you can imagine him thinking the Jedi absolutely should be in this fight, because we're all about peace and respect. And, this is the only way to create us an environment of peace and respect is to defeat the people who are ideologically opposed to peace and respect. And what's seductive about that is that, you know, he's not wrong. I mean, you know, if your whole mission is protecting the peace and these people are out there, you know, slaughtering civilians, enslaving them, taking away their freedoms, and there's a real, you know, stench of darkness on the other side. I mean, do you just sit there in your temple and let this happen? I mean, I don't, you know, there's a thorny, you know, conversation to be had here about whether the Jedi had a choice, you know, other than to get involved in this war. Now, did they have to become the generals themselves and actually assume responsibility for the strategic decisions? Could they have perhaps been deployed in an elite capacity by, you know, civilian Republic officials to rescue hostages and save civilians? I mean, is there some other role that they could have had? Sure, absolutely. But I think what makes this whole plan of Sidious's so smart is that, you know, it's appealing to the guardians of peace to stand up to people who are threatening the peace. It feels like it should be part of their mission, but it's all about how that works. It's all about the particulars, the mechanics of it. And slowly but surely, they are worn down by the realities of this war. It is far more, I think it's safe to say, it's far more than they bargained for.
I think that's definitely the case, and you put it very eloquently. I also think that for Anakin, the war offers an opportunity for him to go after the darkness that exists in the galaxy that he wouldn't have the opportunity to as a regular Jedi. Like, this is one of the things that I really do not think Star Wars went into enough at all, is that he was enslaved as a child, and, you know, the movies and the show for the most part glaze over that, even when the show does the extremely problematic, but that's a whole different conversation, Zygeria arc that sort of goes into Anakin's childhood. It really only scratches the surface, and you can see how someone who's really angry that he's joined this order that's supposedly all about peace in the galaxy and yet isn't willing to end slavery in the galaxy, you can see how it would also be incredibly appealing for him personally to be able to finally fight those targets that he's wanted to fight rightfully in some ways for as long as he has been a Jedi. So I think there's a point to that. And then also the other thing that you said that really got me thinking was about whether the Jedi could have been employed in a more useful capacity, and I definitely think that they could have, but as I'm thinking about it, you know, it was always going to be a slippery slope where basically you have people with superpowers and you want the people with superpowers to be fighting your battles, and so I think it would be very difficult for them to end up being anything other than on the front lines, which is not what they were made for, not what they're prepared for. But it's easy to see how they were put in that position, because it would seem like they uniquely had capabilities to ostensibly end a war very quickly, and then they just get really overwhelmed.
Yeah, and I mean, to go back to something you said earlier, there's also this really blatant sort of corruptive aspect of leading clones who are bred for this. I mean, you know, they are getting their hands dirty in terms of supervising people who have no choice in this matter, who were, created for this purpose. I mean, that is corrosive right there. Just that, regardless of how the battles go and how the war goes and how many people have to die, even if no one died. I mean, that right there is testing their commitment to the Republic. And you can imagine if the Force had a voice, it would probably, you know, say that this is antithetical to the ideals of the Jedi, to tacitly condone through continued cooperation the existence of a slave army. And the only reason that we don't really talk about them as a slave army more often is because they're clearly on the good side, and a lot of them relish fighting the good fight. But that's a tricky thing to even acknowledge, that they relish it, because they were created to do it. So of course they were programmed to want to do it. We really get into some dicey questions of free will there, and it really raises questions about a lot of things in the Clone Wars and the Bad Batch in terms of, are any of these people's thoughts, could any of them be said to be their own, quote unquote? Now that we could do a whole separate episode about that, but just the fact that the Jedi are around that moral conundrum is also very corrosive.
Exactly. And I think too, that pretty much as soon as the Jedi accepted in episode 2 that they were going to use this convenient clone army that just drops into their lap out of nowhere, and instead of being like, this is weird and also bad, they go, well, you know, you don't look a gift clone army in the mouth, and use it for their problem on Geonosis. I think that's really kind of the first domino in their corruption in becoming leaders of the Clone War. And you're gonna knock those dominoes down, and eventually it's going to result in them breaking apart, because I think by accepting the use of the clone army, which, as you said, is essentially a slave army, they are kind of betraying one of their fundamental principles, and it's untenable ultimately for them to continue in this manner without kind of falling apart.
Yeah. And you know, we shouldn't underestimate the value that, you know, that speed plays in Sidious's plan, because they find out about the clone army, you know, they have that council discussion, or maybe it's just Yoda and Mace Windu, where Obi-Wan says, you know, did Sifo Dyas authorize this? And they say no, certainly not with the council's permission. And there's some acknowledgement at the end of that scene that this is very disturbing, and we need to figure out what's going on here. And, you know, bring Jango Fett back, and we'll figure this all out. And then things obviously spiral from there, and their backs are up against the wall. And are they going to sit around and commune with the Force to figure out what happened here? Or are they going to save Obi-Wan, Anakin, and a Republic senator? You know, Sidious forces their hand there. And it's almost a microcosm of how the broader conflict does not give them time to step back and think about what they're doing, and also think about whether or not it's right.
One of the things that this conversation really has me thinking about, and I do think about pretty often, is that Sidious' plan is brilliant. And I mean, we joke about there being so many ways it could have failed, and there are, but in a lot of ways, I mean, it was pretty foolproof, pretty airtight, which is why it's bananas that this one guy, like this one random dude, is just able to completely take down a millennia old sacred order and a millennia old government with just, you know, a fair amount of planning and 3 years of war. Like, that's just crazy.
Well, and listen, I mean, I do want to talk about the degree to which he himself and his own personal use of the Force blinds the Jedi. But there, you know, there's another aspect to this, which is Qui-Gon, you know, in The Phantom Menace, creates this question for us of the living Force versus the unifying Force. And I was thinking back to a scene on, I think it's on Naboo, where Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan are talking, and Qui-Gon says, "Don't center on your anxieties, Obi-Wan. Keep your concentration on the here and now, where it belongs." Obi-Wan responds, but Master Yoda says I should be mindful of the future. And Qui-Gon says, yes, but not at the expense of the moment. Now, what you have here is this debate between, you know, proponents of the living force who are all about, look, you know, the force manifests in concrete ways. We are living in a world where things are happening around us right now, and we need to grapple with those things. And what's most important is what's around us right now, what we can affect in the here and now. And then you have people like Yoda who are more attached to this idea of the unifying force, this idea that things are headed in a certain direction. We need to try to figure out what is best for the future, how to best position ourselves for the future. We need to try to, if not see the future itself, at least interpret where things are going to the degree that we can so that we can prepare ourselves, so that we can align ourselves with what the force is telling us will be the best path for the future. And to me, you know, Qui-Gon, I think, really rebels against a council that he sees as too preoccupied with what might happen in the future. You know, for example, he's very disappointed with the council saying Anakin is probably not going to turn out to be a good fit for the Jedi Order because of how he was raised. We don't think this is going to be good for the future. It's certainly not based on anything in the present. I mean, they obviously say you're thinking too much about your mother, but that in itself is not some kind of sin. It's more, what does that mean for the future, right? So Qui-Gon is like, no, let's focus on if he can serve us and serve the Order now. Can we train him now? And Yoda and Mace Windu's perspective is sort of more like, we can see this going down a dark path, so we're going to try to preclude that entirely. And, you know, I think there's a real question about whether the Council's obsession with the future clouds their minds to what is happening around them and makes them reluctant to open their minds to the kinds of arguments that Qui-Gon is making about the importance of, you know, of the now and of the immediate, of our immediate circumstances and not trying to get too far ahead of ourselves. And last thing I'll say is, in, you know, Yoda certainly says in, throughout the prequels that you can't see the future, but where he really espouses that view is in the original trilogy, after he has seen the error of his ways and after he has realized that Qui-Gon seems to have had the better argument about what the Jedi should do. That is when he really leans heavily on always in motion is the future. You know, Obi-Wan tells Luke, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. Even Yoda can't see their fate. That is really, I think, when he starts to recognize the broader problems that the Jedi faced and kind of, maybe at that point acknowledging, yeah, Qui-Gon was right. We missed the ball.
I think, I mean, you raised so many good points in that. And as we see in the media outside of the movies, Yoda does lean on Qui-Gon in learning how to manifest in the Force as a Force ghost and also come to understand the more Qui-Gon-esque view of the Force, focusing on the here and now instead of the future. But I think what this really brings to my mind is something, a point I think I made or at least was trying to make earlier, which is that the war may have accelerated the failures of the Republic and the Jedi, but Sidious's plan and the fall of these two institutions couldn't have happened if they weren't already on that path. They were already crumbling, and that can be seen in the prequels and in particularly in Phantom Menace, if you read through the lines, that the Jedi Order is incredibly set in its ways and unwilling to consider alternative viewpoints, which is why Qui-Gon is so frustrated with them and later contributes to why Anakin is so frustrated with them. Because Anakin has been manipulated basically his whole life. But he does have a point that the Jedi Order is super rigid and really never willing to consider that it might be wrong or that its way of thinking might be wrong, that there might be other ideas out there, other ways of looking at the Force, of looking at what a Jedi's responsibility should be. And that is a big contributor to their fall. And basically what the war does, I think, is just speed up something that was already going to happen. Like, maybe it would have been a slow death for the Jedi Order as we know it. But what the war does is really make sure that these two institutions, the Jedi and the Republic, which were already old and bloated and in many ways corrupt, and making sure that they don't just disintegrate, but that they break, and that it seems like there's no coming back from their destruction.
So let me bounce off of that and ask about, you know, Sidious's influence. There's a great moment in, I'm pretty sure it's Revenge of the Sith, where Mace Windu says to Yoda, "I think it is time we inform the Senate that our ability to use the Force has diminished." And Yoda basically warns him off by saying that would create panic. And, you know, for all that these movies have been dissected and analyzed, and for all that we've learned more about things that are mentioned in these movies, this idea of, you know, the shroud of the dark side and their ability to use the Force has diminished, I mean, I really don't think that has been explored much. On a mechanical level, what does it mean that their ability to use the Force has diminished? Is that just Mace Windu's way of saying we've lost touch with our ideals, that our ability to commune with the Force has been reduced by practical factors related to the war? Or is he actually saying that there is some kind of wet blanket smothering their connection to this mystical energy field, that on a very practical level, they are no longer able to commune with it in the way that they used to, not because of, you know, schedules, but because of something in the nature of the Force? I think that is a fascinating concept. And again, I don't think we get a lot on it and how it works and what it means, or really where it comes from. I think it's pretty clear that it's Sidious doing something, as opposed to, you know, the background corruption that you and I have been talking about is sort of wounding the Force in some way and is causing the Force to be less available to the Jedi, independent of Sidious's own direct decisions. I think it's more the former, that he is causing this problem. But I'm curious what you think that plays in the corruption that we're talking about here. I think we both agree that structural factors have already corrupted the Jedi by the time Sidious begins enacting his plan, but to what extent does this, you know, kneecap their ability to pull themselves out of this crisis?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and an interesting point. And for me, the idea that Sidious himself is so powerful that he can sort of unilaterally disrupt the Force is kind of boring. That's the answer. It's just, I don't like the idea of there's just this guy and he's really powerful. He's just super powerful. He's just so powerful, you guys, and he's so powerful that he can disrupt the use of the Force. That's how crazy powerful he is. And I mean, sure, that's maybe he's just, to continue overusing an overused word, maybe he just really is powerful. But that to me kind of feeds into like the problem you have in Rise of Skywalker, where it's just this bad guy who's been pulling the strings all along. And why? It's because he's a bad guy and he can, and he has that power. And I think personally that it's a lot more interesting to have the reason that they're no longer able to connect with the Force as much is indirectly due to Sidious, is because this war has been orchestrated by him. But it's more about what the war did to them as individuals, like we were talking about earlier, and how that has hindered their understanding of the Force and their ability to connect with it. So that's just my take.
Yeah, I agree with you that this idea that he is just really powerful and that that's the end of the explanation is not very satisfying. But again, you know, this is not something that we really know a lot about. This is one of those remaining gray areas in terms of how powerful is he? What rituals is he performing that allow this to happen? I mean, certainly the fact that Yoda and Mace Windu cannot sense that this man in his office sitting across a table from them is the Sith Lord speaks to a degree of power that I would argue is probably unprecedented in Star Wars. I think that that represents a level of control and a level of manipulation that we don't really see anybody else approach. And, you know, does that mean that that is the shroud of the dark side, that he is cloaking himself from them and at the same time diminishing their own ability to reach out and sense things and understand the universe around them through the Force? We don't have that information, unfortunately. I don't even necessarily know that I want the answer. You know, maybe that's kind of a question for you, is do you want this to be something we get an answer for, or do you want it to be, you know, the way that they're treating Yoda's species and the origins of that species as just this kind of deliberate blank spot in the Star Wars lore?
Yeah, I do think it is more interesting as an unanswered question. I also think that there has been literature looking at Palpatine's origins, like in comic books or books. I just haven't read it. So I will add to my analysis that caveat so that if some Hoth Takes listener is like, well, actually, this is all explained in this comic, number 6. I have not read that comic, and so sorry about that. My analysis is therefore not fully informed by all of the Star Wars media that's out there. But I do think it is more interesting to leave it as an open question and leave his level of power as an open question too. And then my final thought, I guess, on this topic is that sometimes I get to the point where I think, oh my God, you are really overthinking this. Because Star Wars, as much as I love it, and I do love it desperately, clearly, and could talk about it all day, at the end of the day, like, in very basic terms, it's bare bones, and this is especially true in the original trilogy. It's just a space fantasy story, and maybe that there's just a super powerful bad guy because that's what the narrative demanded, and there's no reason for it other than that, and that's okay too. Like, that's something that I find personally unsatisfying, but also I understand that maybe it's just that narratively this was the easiest route.
Yeah, so two things. First, you know, to your point about not having read the books and comics, yeah, there's stuff in the expanded universe about him and Darth Plagueis and how he does what he does, but I'm sort of excluding that from my analysis just because it's not canon. It doesn't speak to the story, the unified story that they're currently trying to tell with Star Wars. I guess I would make this point for Hoth Takes in general. I try not to factor the EU into my sort of analysis of the story. It, obviously, when we talk about specific EU books and comics, that's different. But in terms of like the canonical truth of Star Wars, that's not part of it. And, you know, don't email me. The other thing I would say is, to your point about that's what the narrative demanded, I mean, I always like to bring this up, that I like to at least acknowledge the sort of meta-textual fact that this isn't real, and so it's all, like, certain things only exist to drive towards some ending, right? So, like, these characters were created to tell a story. They only do what the creators want them to do. And so some things don't necessarily make sense the way they would if this were all real and all these people actually had their own, you know, willpower. Because all this is being created to drive toward, in the case of Episode 3, Order 66 and the creation of Darth Vader and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, George Lucas did what he had to do with these characters to tell that story. So we cannot expect that there will be an easily discernible logical answer for all these questions that we have, because this isn't real and not every question was answered by the creators. And some questions were sort of left open in a way where a logical answer may not be forthcoming, because certain things were just created in an arbitrary way, again, to tell a story. So that's the only thing I would say about that, is that, yes, we do need to acknowledge that it's not as if we're sitting here analyzing the causes of World War One, right, where real people did real things, and whether you agree with them or not, you can at least trace back, you know, decisions in a way, because it really happened. We can try to understand people's decisions, because that really happened. This just, there's no analog here in terms of the logic that you can put to certain things.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And also, I, like you, think that getting meta is, I think that's fun. And I think it's fun to acknowledge that this isn't real, and we can have so many arguments about it. And there are so many fun jokes about all the ways that Palpatine's plan could have gone wrong. But it didn't go wrong because it couldn't go wrong. Narratively, it had to go right. And that's really why he succeeded. And I think that's just another fun element to the conversation, is getting a little meta. So I appreciate you going there with me.
You know, speaking of arguments, do we want to save the whole conversation about the no attachments policy for another episode? Because I think it's a core component of this broader question of, did the Jedi lose their way? Is, you know, were those kinds of rigid rules that they had for various things wise or appropriate or smart? And I, you know, that's clearly a part of this conversation. It's a big can of worms. Do we want to save it for another time?
Ooh, I do think that no attachment may be too big for this episode. Because I mean, that's something that I could go on for another half hour about, and no one wants that.
I think our Hoth Takes listeners might want that. So let's put a pin in that, and let's definitely do a separate episode about it.
Agreed. Yes, but for the moment of brief analysis, I will say that I do think the no attachments things and how they enforced it was part of how they got rigid and stuck, and we can go more into that in a future episode.
Yeah, and if anybody is reading or, you know, the High Republic comics and books, the way that the Jedi of that era talk about attachments and love and sex and everything like that is really interesting when you think about where they're going to be 200 years later. So just a little plug for that. That's what I have on my list, Grace. Is there anything I have not mentioned that you think is important to get in there?
I think, you know, we mostly focused on the Jedi, and that makes sense because there's a lot more literature about the Jedi, and the focus of the movies is on the Jedi and not the Republic Senate itself. So it makes sense that we focus more on it. But I do think that it is worth noting that the Senate was very flawed, and maybe there was no other option, because, you know, maybe having so many friggin' planets and representatives of varying interests would necessarily lead to corruption. But I think it is interesting to not push out the Republic in our considerations of the fall of the Jedi, but to include the Republic and the Senate in those conversations and think of it also as an institution that was failing by the time the war came around.
Absolutely. I mean, part of why the Jedi's relationship with the Republic is so poisonous to the Jedi is because of what the Republic is. If the Republic were a well-oiled machine, some of these questions about should the Jedi be serving as this police force would be different. But as it is, yes, I mean, this is not an institution that is serving the people well. It's not an institution that is functioning well. And so when the Jedi have to be a part of that machine that is not working well, that is ultimately what starts to create these problems, is that they're being captured by a malfunctioning system. So absolutely, I mean, the malfunction of that system is a key part of the problem here. And that arguably is the space where Palpatine is able to be more directly manipulative.
Right. Yeah. That was pretty much it. That was my point. And you capped it off very well, so.
All right. Well, we hope everyone enjoyed this episode. And definitely, you know, let us know what you think. Let us know, you know, whether you agree that the Jedi were doomed to fail from, you know, long before the Clone Wars. And we'd love to hear some perspectives on where they went wrong and how they went wrong. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Like I said, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to share your thoughts or suggest topics that we can tackle in future shows, go ahead and email us at hothtakes@gmail.com. If you want to tweet at us, you can also find us on Twitter at hothtakes. I'm at Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is at Grace_Seegers. And Haley, who we hope is having so much fun right now, is at Burdenator. Haley made our logo and banner art. I edited the show and put together our music, and we should point out for legal purposes, all Star Wars themes and sound effects remain the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. If you like the show, we'd love it if you'd share it with a couple friends. You can tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.